This is Cotta v. District Court, 71267. Justice Cherry is homesick, but he will participate after listening to the tape and reviewing the video. Justice Pickering is disqualified in this matter. Mr. Morris, if you're ready to proceed, please do so. If you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
Good afternoon, members of the court and others present. I'd like to speak to you for 10 minutes now, or not more than 10 minutes, reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'd like to open by saying I wish all of us here a very happy and prosperous new year. As I can say, I think I can say on my behalf of myself and others, we're going to miss you next year.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Steve Morris, I am representing the plaintiff, James J. Cotta, individually, and as a derivative plaintiff. I would like to preface my remarks by putting in context the various lawyers and the proceedings that give rise to this writ. Alexander Robertson is a lawyer and was a lawyer in one of the cases that was consolidated with this one that was before Judge Gonzalez for a couple of years, in which he represented intervening plaintiffs suing the same defendants on the same claims as the client I represent, James J. Cotta, is suing. They sued the same defendants on the same claims, and the cases were put together for a period of time until the intervening plaintiffs settled their case. But during the time, these cases were coordinated and together and jointly administered by Judge Gonzalez. Mark Crum, who represents Mr. Cotta along with me, and Alexander Robertson, representing the intervening plaintiffs, exchanged a great deal of information with respect to this litigation. That information exchange became the subject of discovery requests and motion practice in the district court, and it resulted in the production of 350 emails between Mr. Crum, or Mr. Cotta's lawyers, and Alexander Robertson, representing the intervening plaintiff. What it did not involve, and what is at issue here today, is an additional 150 communications, emails between Mr. Robertson and Mr. Crum to coordinate and to share information with respect to this litigation against the common defendants they were suing. It is those emails that were withheld, and they were appropriately withheld, I submit, and they were withheld and privilege logged, and they were described adequately as communications that were not subject to production because they contained the mental impressions and strategic discussions with respect to prosecuting this case or those coordinated cases against the common defendants. That's what this dispute is about. Whether those documents that reflect the strategy, the mental impressions, and the efforts made by plaintiffs with a common interest, both suing the same defendants on the same claims.
Mr. Morris, my understanding was Judge Gonzalez did not do an in-camera review of these emails.
Not.
And were any findings made by how she came to this conclusion that there was a common interest waiver here.
The judge's remarks and her position on this, there was a great deal of motion practice, but her remarks that shed light on, to the extent that light can be shed on the answer to your question, all she said was, and we've set it out here several times in the papers, just because you, Mr. Crum, and Alexander Robertson are co-plaintiffs, that doesn't create a common interest. So the motion the motion to produce these documents that contain your mental impressions and those of Mr. Robertson in moving this case along toward trial against these common defendants is denied. You must produce those documents. So, that led to this writ.
Now, she didn't make any, I'm sorry to interrupt you, she didn't make any particularized findings as to why it wasn't a common interest.
She did not.
She just announced that.
She didn't do an in-camera production. She was insistent that we provide a privilege log, mm-hmm. which the court's entitled to and the other parties are entitled to, which we did. And we even amended the law to conform to her requirements to number the documents that were logged. And yet, when it came down to time to determine whether these documents reflected work product or not and were appropriately withheld, the judge didn't examine, didn't inquire into it. She just simply said, the fact that you're co-plaintiffs doesn't mean you have a common interest. Now, I suggest, and we cover this in our papers, I suggest that that cryptic remark by the judge indicates some confusion on her part with respect to attorney-client privilege and the waiver of it, and common interest privilege, or common interest sufficient to support the withholding of information on work product basis, because a number of the arguments made in the district court below were for the purpose of showing that there was a waiver of privilege when Mr. Crum produced the 350 documents that I described to you earlier, but not the 150 that were withheld.
Mr. Morris, the district court never, I guess even to this date, hasn't issued a formal written order.
Pardon me?
The district court, I guess even to this date, has not issued a written order.
Just recently did.
Yeah, on this issue.
Pardon on this, not on this issue.
On this matter, the subject of this writ, is there a written order from the district court?
I don't have it. I don't know the answer to that question. We have her decision, and
well, we have it in the minutes.
Pardon?
We have it in the minutes.
Yes, we do.
But we don't have
and you the. Have it in the transcript. That's submitted to you.
Right. But it was there a written order that followed?
I believe there was, but I don't have personal knowledge of that.
So my concern is whether there was anything in the written order that said anything more or less than what was contained in the transcript regarding the judge's reasoning or assessment of the papers, the arguments that were made by counsel before the hearing.
The answer to that question is, from the review of the documents I've done, and I confess to you that I don't now identify specifically the order denying this, but the orders the court did in the documents I reviewed, there is no analysis such as you're asking about.
As an aside, this court has declined to entertain writs and even declined to consider appeals where there's no written order.
this is a concern. And I wondered if you could address that. And you're maybe not in a position to do so because you haven't seen a written order.
I can't tell you any more on that than I have, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I guess you filed this, Mr. Morris, because it was an emergency. I assume she ordered forthwith to produce these emails, and your challenge would have been defeated if you didn't file this petition.
Yes.
Okay. Hey. Excuse me, Mr. Morris. Did you move for a stay?
Yes, and it was granted.
Okay.
And there's a stay. There's a stay in effect until this is disposed of.
Right.
So, well, my time is up, even though I didn't anticipate it would be.
I think you still have 5 minutes, so we
could. 5 minutes of that for a while.
Right, right.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Happy New Year. May it please the court. My name is Marshall Searcy. I'm here on behalf of real parties in interest and responding parties, Margaret Cotter, Ellen Cotter, Ed Kane, Doug McEachran, Guy Adams, Judy Cotting, and Michael Rodian.
The directors of this corporation?
They're most of the directors, Your Honor, but not two of them were represented separately.
Okay.
The answer, before you get started, Justice Hart, you just asked a question about an order. Are you aware of an order?
I do believe that there was an order. I'm going from memory because I did not bring the record with me to go through it, but I believe there was an order. There was a motion made to stay that order in the district court. That district court application was denied, and then a petitioner brought his claim, brought his case to this court, and there was a stay that was granted almost immediately. With respect to...
So there is a written order?
It's my understanding that there is, Your Honor. Again, going from memory, I certainly recall there being one. As to the separate question that Your Honor asked about what was contained in the order, it's my recollection that the order said that our motion was granted, and that is about the extent of what's contained in the order. Now, the record that's been presented to the court here today is certainly a voluminous record, and I'd like to kind of get into the details of that to talk about what's really not in dispute here.
Could you say, if Justice Douglas, chief, agrees, could you send us the order, supplement the record, so we can see what it says?
Of course.
Okay, thank you.
More than happy to do that with you this afternoon. The legal issue here, the issue of law that's been primarily presented on this appeal, is whether a litigant waives work product protection when materials are shared with potential adversaries without the protection of any confidentiality agreement. And, Your Honors, I believe that under the law that's been set forth by this court, under the law that's been set forth in the federal courts throughout the U.S., there is a waiver under those circumstances. And to talk about that, the background facts here are primarily undisputed, especially as they relate to this issue of adversity. Plaintiff here, the petitioner, Jim Cotter, is a member of the Reading Board of Directors. He's a derivative plaintiff also. He's doing that at the same time. And he's brought suit against my clients derivatively. And he's also asserted claims against all the other members of the Board of Directors of Reading at various times. From August of 2014 to June of 2015, he was the CEO of Reading. And his claims in this derivative action primarily relate to his termination. He says that termination was improper, and he is seeking to get his old job back as CEO in connection with his derivative claims. The communications that are at issue in this writ are between the petitioner's counsel, Mr. Mark Crum, who's contained in the privilege logs in the record, and the counsel for a group of hedge funds using the name T2. That's Mr. Robertson, who was identified for you earlier by Mr. Morris. T2 was also, for a time, plaintiffs in the case, and they intervened in the action. It's undisputed that the communications between petitioner's counsel and T2's counsel were not the subject of any confidentiality agreement. They're not the subject of any joint prosecution agreement. Instead, what petitioner has claimed here is that there is a common interest. But petitioner also admitted on the record in front of Judge Gonzalez that he couldn't enter into any confidentiality with T2 or its counsel because there would be a conflict of interest. Petitioner's counsel said that for him to do so would be contrary to his obligations and directives as a member of the board of directors of Red, the company that he sued derivative. We also know that it's basically undisputed in this case, Your Honors, that T2 was a potential litigation adversary against petitioner Mr. Cotter. We know that because even though they never sued each other, T2 brought claims in his first complaint, which was filed on August 19th of 2015, against the directors of Red. They specifically excluded Mr. Cotter Jr., the petitioner. However, the claims were against transactions that were approved by the entire board of Red. So one of those transactions was an approved payment to the estate of Mr. Cotter Jr.'s father, the appellant's father here. And T2, the plaintiff, alleged that that transaction was waste and was bringing a derivative claim based on that transaction. They also brought, in February of 2016, additional claims against the board of directors of Reading, saying that Reading had breached, or the members of the board of directors had breached their fiduciary duties. Petitioner said that the board had approved payment of funds by Reading to pay for his father's share of real estate investments, that that was a breach of fiduciary duty. And they also alleged that when Mr. Cotter Jr., the petitioner here, hired an in-house lawyer named Bill Ellis, that that had been wasteful and was also subject to derivative claims. So even though they were both nominally plaintiffs in this case, petitioner, Mr. Cotter Jr., and T2 also had adverse claims against each other. And that continued, Your Honors.
Potential
adverse claims. That's correct. That's correct. But those claims were spelled out in T2's complaint as being against the board of directors of Reading for transactions they didn't
intervene. You agree there was a benefit to the plaintiffs and the intervening plaintiffs to work in concert to prepare their case and put their case against the defendants.
Your Honor, certainly whenever you can share resources, sure, there's a benefit.
The coordination.
But usually what parties do who are acting with each other, where there's a benefit to sharing those resources, is if there's some sort of conflict, as is admitted here by a petitioner, then you enter into a confidentiality agreement. You do something to ensure that those communications between the two parties don't get disclosed to your other adversaries.
Do you have a case in the material you cited that says that it's a conditioned precedent to the work product privilege to have a confidentiality agreement?
No, Your Honor, I would not make that.
You're suggesting, I'm inferring from your argument, that that's an element of the work product privilege or the common interest privilege, and I don't see that in the law.
Certainly in the law.
It might be reasonable practice to avoid conflict issues or clarify the relationship, but it's not the test in determining whether there's a common interest privilege.
And I understand your point on that, Your Honor. The point that I'm trying to make is somewhat different.
Okay.
Because I'm talking about the context of the waiver of the work product protection here. And
let's start with the first question. Did these parties have a common interest privilege before you ever get to waiver? They certainly had a common interest in suing your client.
So, Your Honor, they were both plaintiffs.
Yes.
So to that extent, there might be a potential for a common interest. However, they also had adversity between the two of them and had adverse claims against each other, potentially, as Your Honor has pointed out. So it would be our position here that common interest did not exist. And, in fact, on the record, that's the statement that Judge Gonzalez made, was that the fact that both parties were plaintiffs in this case was not sufficient to show by itself a common interest.
But wasn't there some indication that the intervening plaintiffs included allegations very similar to the petitioner's relating to the petitioner's termination and other events?
And there were certainly overlapping claims with the first complaint that was filed by the intervening company, T2. In fact, it appeared that they had actually duped and revised the complaint that had been filed by petitioner in many respects. But as the litigation continued, it became apparent that that common interest didn't exist. And it was really highlighted when the T2 plaintiffs settled with Reading and with my clients. They dismissed their claims for no money and issued a press release saying that they had looked at the corporate records, they had received discovery, and that they were satisfied with what they'd seen and satisfied with the way in which petitioner's termination had been handled. So that throughout this litigation, there were conflicts between the parties and adverse positions taken by the parties.
But before all of that happened, there was all this communication between T2 and the other party.
Well, to answer your question or your point on that, Your Honor, the first communications that are logged by petitioner in this case are in August, and the T2 complaint that contains the allegation, what they call the golden coffin allegation, was also filed on August 19th of 2015. So that adversity between the parties was there from the outset of the communication.
The district court didn't make those findings.
Well, Your Honor, to answer that question or to respond to that point, there were a series of four different motions that we brought over the course of this. And throughout, the district court had to continue pushing petitioner to actually place these documents on law. And in fact, after petitioner conceded in June that there was no joint interest agreement or common interest agreement between them, it was not until August of 2015 that the log was actually received. So throughout, the district court was continuing to obtain facts from petitioner about the basis for his claims.
But counsel, that's part of the concerns, as was echoed before, in terms of the state of the law in Nevada as to having to have that agreement, number one. Number two, Nevada, unlike a number of jurisdictions, has not really recognized that common interest exception, so to speak. So there's some problems, and looking at what we have from without the order, and you were saying, and the order didn't say much, the mere fact that petitioner, the intervening plaintiffs, are both plaintiffs is not sufficient for a common interest. That's basically the finding the court made.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is the finding that the court made.
So that doesn't go to the depth that you're talking about in terms of this need for a written agreement.
Well, with respect to that, Your Honor, there was a statement also made on the record from the prior hearing where there was the concession made by petitioner's counsel that there was no written agreement, no joint defense agreement to protect the confidentiality of documents. And in fact, then at the next hearing after that, there was the concession by petitioner's counsel that he couldn't enter into such an agreement because of the conflict created by his being on the board of directors of Red. And the test as to whether there is a waiver, and the court articulated this test recently in the case of Wynn versus Okada, is whether the disclosure substantially increases the opportunities for potential adversaries to obtain the information. And there's no question here that you've got T2 as a potential adversary, but in addition to that, without there being any sort of confidentiality agreement that govern disclosure of the materials between T2 and between petitioner, there was nothing preventing T2 from providing those materials to us or to anyone else.
Mr. Searcy, the confidentiality agreements that you're describing protect the plaintiffs from each other. That protects them from each other.
In many instances, yes, Your Honor.
But the common interest, adversaries can still share a common interest and share work product materials in the absence of a confidentiality agreement.
And I agree with that point, Your Honor. However, as in this case, there is an adversarial relationship that is permeating the entire thing to the point where petitioner accused T2 of collusion with our side, then in that instance, good practice certainly would require that you have to have a confidentiality agreement to protect those materials, because you don't have the type of coincidence of interest that would then prevent someone like T2 from disclosing those materials to potential adversaries. And that's the test for waiver on work product, Your Honors. Is the material, has it now been disclosed to a potential adversary such that it can be disclosed to other adversaries? And if it has been disclosed in such a way, then there has been a waiver of the work product. Your Honor, it's our position that there's been a waiver of the work product here, that the court, after undertaking four separate motions to compel, having four separate hearings, after having received the privilege log and made findings about the lack of common interest between the parties being sufficient to protect those, that the order should be upheld here in the document.
So you talk about that privilege log almost like it answers the questions, but if I understand correctly, the court did no inspection as the 150 emails are in question. There was conversation as the 300 previously, I understand, on the record, but the 150, the court didn't know what was contained within them.
If the question is, Your Honor, did the court undertake an in-camera review of the documents, the 150 documents that were listed on the log, the answer is no, it did not. However, having had the four prior hearings, the court certainly knew what the factual background was, and it had the record which indicated that all...
Actually, we have to question that, because we don't know what the court knew if they didn't look at the 150 documents.
And if I may just respond to that point quickly, Your Honor, the 150 documents that are listed on the log all show communications between plaintiff's counsel, petitioner's counsel, as well as Mr. Robertson, counsel for T2. That's what's disclosed, and then a boilerplate description of each of the documents. And the court, respectively, had received enough information to know that there was not a sufficient common interest there for those documents.
And the concern that's been expressed is the lack of specificity in what the court did. Maybe that order has a little more in it and will help us, but that's a concern.
We'll provide that order to you this afternoon. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Morris?
Your Honor, thank you. I'd like to clarify one point if I can. And that is, there were no adverse claims made between a counsel describes as the T2 plaintiffs, the intervening plaintiffs, and the petitioner. There were references to relationships and facts, but there were no adverse claims made by Mr. Cotter against the intervening plaintiffs, or vice versa. What we have here is a description, and somewhat of a misdescription by the respondent, that a series of motions with respect to discovery disputes familiarized the court with the facts of the work product doctrine that was the subject of, or is the subject of, the withheld document. And that, in addition, is just not the case. The court never made any examination, didn't consider any. What the court did was, and I submit to you, it was error to do that. What the court did was, it just simply said, the fact that the two of you are friendly and you are co-plaintiffs against common defendants is not enough to show common interest. And the cases tell us that that just is not what the law is.
What about counsel's...
if I can...
Excuse me one second. Counsel's statement that... petitioners actually accused T2 of collusion at some point. That would...
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
I said counsel indicated earlier that T2 or petitioner had alleged at some point T2 was colluding with the other side. How does that demonstrate a common interest? That seems to undercut your argument.
I don't know. I don't know that. I don't know. And I don't. That was not the subject of any claim or motion practice. There were a lot of exchanges of points of view during the course of this proceeding over discovery disputes that could have been something that was said or referred to in the course of one of those disputes. But there is no claim. There was no claim that there was collusion between T2 and the defendants. It wasn't. And I think if we can come back to, and this is what I didn't get to discuss with you in the first instance, I'm mindful about the order and will make absolutely certain that the order is in the record if it isn't already, and I just don't know where in the record it is. I know a stay was entered, and I know we were ordered to produce documents within a relatively short period of time before that stay was entered and this proceeding took place. In the opposition, or the answer, to this writ petition, the plaintiffs make, or the defendants make, a good deal out of a number of cases that I believe are distinguishable. But one in particular they set out and call to mind and quote from on page 20 of their answer, I would like to direct your attention to. It is Niagara Mohawk Power Company versus Stone and Webster Engineering Corporation. Now, the defendants cite this case for the proposition that there has been a waiver of work product by the production of documents between Mr. Crum and Mr. Robertson that did not include any mental impressions or litigation strategy. This is what Mohawk Power had to say on this topic, which they didn't cite to you when they discussed Mohawk Power, and that is sharing work product material with a friendly party, and there's no question in the district court's mind or in the minds of the parties to this case that the intervening plaintiffs, whether we refer to them as the T2 plaintiffs or just as the intervening plaintiffs, and James Carter, were friendly with respect to the prosecution of their claims against common defendants. The Niagara Mohawk Power case says sharing work product material with a friendly party does not waive the work product protection as it applies to an adverse third party, which is Mr. Searcy's clients, the defendants. I'd like to talk to you more, but I'm out of time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morris. Mr. Searcy, thank you. Likewise. This matter will stand submitted. I would ask that at least by Monday of next week, the order, if there is such a thing, be submitted to the court.